There is a poet who calls rhythm the idiom of the unconscious. Repetition, he says, makes us feel safe, and variation sets us free. I'm Susan McGinnis. On this edition of Conversations, we'll take a look at rhythms and oral and written traditions and poetry through the eyes of poet Naomi Shihab Nye. Stay with us. Naomi, thanks for coming, and welcome back.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we did this about 4 years ago. It's a pleasure to sit down again.
It certainly is.
That poet is also literary critic Robert Haas, who said repetition is the N. Actually, he said that's important. Repetition is an idiom of the unconscious. Mm. I want your take on that. I'm going to give you a couple more words so you can think about it. He preceded that thought by saying, we are rhythm-discerning individuals. For whatever reason in our evolutionary history, we attend to rhythm almost instinctively, signaling to us, like to grazing animals or hunting animals, that something in the environment has changed. Mm. Does some part of that resonate with you? I found it a real riveting thought.
Yeah, it all does. I love Robert Haas's comments as well as his poetry, and that's really a wonderful quote. Well, I've always felt very attuned to the rhythm of daily language, conversation, even before I felt attuned to the language of written literature or written poetry or story. And that sense of sort of perching, always perching on the edge of someone else's line and tipping your head and feeling the timing, the rhythm, the place where to come back with something is very deeply rooted, I think, in the heart and soul of everybody who writes. And that idea about repetition is a really wonderful one. I've always felt attracted to repetition. I think most human beings do, in a very primeval, deep place. And many times people feel shy and awkward about using it in their writing as they get older. They feel they have to apologize in some way if they're going to repeat something.
Like it's a technique or a fall back on it instead of fall into it.
Or an easy way out, which it isn't at all. I'm just musing upon this because it's such a rich idea that we repeat. I think every time we write in a way, we also repeat that opening up to language and that opening up to experience, that sense of beginning with it. So, yes. I vote yes. It's good.
He has another one about image where he says image is, images are not quite ideas. He says they're not myths and they're not metaphors. They're closer to pure story. Mm-hmm. And then he pauses and he says, if we were in the 19th century considering the word image, we would say images put us in touch with the eternal. And I, once again, he like opens this wide field for us to talk about. The reason I wanted to throw those two at you is that somehow in poetry particularly, rhythm and image seem to be children of the same family, spouses, intimately connected.
Very closely connected. I like that quote about image, too, because it gives us a sense of the grounding gravity power of an image. I've always felt a little bit skeptical about ideas in a way. You know, when somebody says, I have a good idea, I mean, I'm glad they do and I'm inspired when I have one, but I wonder sometimes about the importance we place upon, you know, needing to have a good idea. What is a good idea? And I think many times when you have a really good idea, it is intricately bonded with image, that the image is the thing which gives it shape and form and allows us to see how we can move through words, how we can move into a story, as he says. I generally find myself beginning with a phrase or an image and not necessarily an idea at all. I mean, the idea comes through those other more tangible things.
As a poet, from the writer's perspective, do you want me as the reader to take on your image, to take in your image, or to spark through your image another image? Or is it that?
I would say the second.
The second one.
Yeah. For my image to be a vehicle in some way for you, to move with it, but definitely to be able to pass beyond it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is Naomi Shihab Nye. We're talking today on Conversations about words and sounds. When Robert was talking about rhythm, I got to thinking about oral tradition, because you say you come from an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. But oral tradition in our culture doesn't, I think, tell me if this is right or wrong from your perspective, doesn't seem to get the respect it might deserve.
Oh, well, I think you're right. People think if it's talked, it's easy somehow. Or if it's in a conversational, colloquial vernacular, that it somehow doesn't deserve the sort of bow of respect that something written, say, in highly academic language might
Or real literature.
Elicit. Right. And so I think there is that feeling, and I don't know where we get it. Maybe we get it from certain kinds of attitudes in during our formative years, our study. I'm always a little bit amused when somebody says, oh, well, we thought, you know, because the word poems was put up there, we thought that this would definitely be, like, the evening would be filled with riddles and it would be difficult and we wouldn't understand most of it. But what a surprise. We knew what you were talking about. And I always think, well, why does that accompany the idea of a poem? Because to me, a poem can be these other oral rhythms and repetitions and tales that are very close to our lives, the closest things to our lives and the closest things to how we think, as opposed to something distanced.
Closed up,
right.
Hard to penetrate.
Right.
Do you think of poetry as oral first or written first?
Well, for me, it has to be oral at the same time as I'm writing it. If I'm not hearing it, if I'm not saying it out loud, I'm in trouble. I need to be able to talk it out loud to myself and to hear the voice in the poem speaking, very important
is
for me.
Is that genetic or familial or an author's choice? Or?
Both, I think, and I think both traditions are very strong in our country. You know, those people who come from a sort of expansive narrative line in poetry, a kind of Whitman-esque line, have that sense of, you know, the sound of it, and other people have much more sort of visual relationship with it, with a stanza, you know, what it looks like on the page, and responding to it in that way. And I don't think it's all separate, though. I think it can go together, because I like many poems that I think were probably not of a more oral vernacular to begin with, although I most strongly respond to ones that I can hear when I read them. So I think it's, you know, and here in Alaska, I think people are very conscious of what oral tradition is and what it gives to everything that comes out of it. And so I think that, you know, in this place, you're particularly lucky to have a sense of that.
Do you think that's a place thing? Well, oral tradition?
Yeah, I think it's stronger in some places than in others. I think in some cases, a rural environment sometimes leads more to an oral tradition versus, say, a highly urban academic environment. I think of it sometimes as being that expansive breadth of the outdoors, too, so that is definitely place-oriented. I feel this in Texas, that there is that sense of an oral kind of storytelling tradition, still very alive, very active, and I have friends who've been involved with that cowboy poetry festival around the United States in recent years that's been really growing. Now they have not only one in one city, but they have quite a few of them in different cities. And that's definitely returning to the sort of ballad tradition and the poem as spoken transmission. And here these things are coming out of big space too, big sky, big air.
I'm not familiar with a cowboy poetry festival. Is that, as you say, from storytelling?
Well, most of the people who come to those, most of the poets are actual working cowboys or ranch people. Yes. And they write as well, and they write a lot about their experience in the ranch lands and in their cowboy heritage. And so, and cowgirl, too, cowwoman, cowman, whatever you want to call it. And so they get together and they share these in these fabulously festive 3- and 4-day events. And they've been playing them more on cable television, you know, people can see them now who don't necessarily go to them, too. And I think lots of tapes have been made of them. But this has all sort of emerged maybe within the past 10 years, that sense of that this tradition is still very alive in the United States. And so hearing it helps, having it applauded, celebrated.
Interesting traditions, perhaps, that bubble under the surface and every now and again come up or become festivals, become something that's that is a new tradition. Naomi Shihab Nye with us today on Conversations. Let me introduce you. Naomi was brought in spring of 1994 to the University of Alaska Fairbanks by the University English Department as one of a series of visiting writers. While she is in town, she has been giving craft lectures and readings and working with writing students. She has been here once before or more than once? Just once before, in 1990. While she is here on this trip, she'll be traveling out farther into Alaska to work with students than she ever has before. Naomi Shihab Nye with us today on Conversations. I wonder if you would read for us. Now, neither you nor I picked out things in particular, although we've got stacks of things, sitting around us. From a new book?
Well, I'll read a recent piece that this speaks to, I guess, my sense of mixtures, which to me has always been very lively since I was born of parents from two different places and travel back to Jerusalem. My father is Palestinian from Jerusalem, as often as I can. And this is from a scene that happened within the past year in Jerusalem. And it's called Half and Half. "You can't be," says a Palestinian Christian on the first feast day after Ramadan. "So, half and half and half and half." He sells glass. He knows about broken bits, chips. "If you love Jesus, you can't love anyone else," says he. And a Catholic Texan jumps to agree. We're standing off the Via Dolorosa near the Holy Sepulchre, filled with Japanese, Italians, Greeks. He's sweeping. He's selling glass pitchers and plates to women who waited long to visit the Holy Land. And the rubbed stones below feet feel holy, and the dusting of powdered sugar across new round faces of date-stuffed mamoul. This morning, we lit the slim white candles which bend over at the waist by noon. We joined a wide family of candles, making our own holes in the sand. Today, for once, the priests weren't fighting in the church for the best spots to stand. As a boy, my father listened to them fight. Then he'd visit the mosque, where, after prayers, men traded gossipy tales. This is why he prays in no language but his own. Why, when I lift the pink wine glass with the elegant stem, I press my lips to every exception. A woman opens a window here and here and here. A woman places a vase of orange flowers on a damp white cloth. I follow her. She is making a soup out of what she had left in the bowl, the shriveled garlic and bent bean. She is leaving nothing out. Well, just, I had a conversation with a writer here in Alaska today about how no matter where we are, we're a mixture of something. You know, no matter what our blood is, I think most of us in our lives end up being a mixture of many places or many traditions just by way of affiliation. You know, somebody comes to Alaska and they end up feeling very close to Alaska after a long time here, even though they may not have been born here, and the traditions of a place enter you. How I feel in Texas, where I wasn't born, and yet I feel very much a part of that place and that tradition. So I'm fascinated in writing as well as in living, as well as in praying, as well as in everything, how things come together and how these elements interweave, interact.
Is it your sense that they remain discreet at the same time as they weave to be create a new Naomi, a new...
And I don't think that there are these absolute choices that people have to make as much as No, I think many times the world calls upon us in some way to make statements a lot. You know, they want to know, what do you believe in? What do you have faith in? What do you stand for? And I think of art as being one of those regions of mixture where you don't have to adhere to one stance. It's much larger than that. You know, you're able to participate and put together all those things which have contributed to your own language or your own experience. So I sort of was laughing when I wrote this poem, but I was a little irritated too at anyone who says, you know, to anyone in life, you can't do something.
Yes.
Of course, the immediate response is, why not?
I am all of my parts.
Yeah, I am all of my parts. And if someone says, well, you can't be half and half, you have to pick one or the other, you know, my immediate instinct is to say, well, half and half and half and half then. There are more halves than you have ever dreamed of. For all of us, not just for me. Yeah. And I think part of the job of a visiting writer anywhere is to acknowledge and to facilitate in some ways people's halves, people's bits, the wealth of experience that we often have and may take for granted if we're in our own place with our own people who know us. And, you know, it's easy to not see ourselves as being as rich in experience as we all are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Naomi has been a traveling writer for over 20 years that I know of, 20 years in American schools as a visiting writer in high schools and colleges, as she is now doing in Alaska, in other nations and on other continents, a good deal in the Middle East, but not just there, South and Central Americas and Canada and
Asia
as well. To the Middle East and to other places through the United States Information Agency Arts America program, writers program, and other arts program. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that this seems to be as an ambassadorial position in some ways. Do you see that?
I think it is. Yes, I do see that.
Mm-hmm. How so? Tell me what that is for you.
Well, I think it's very important. I think our government is being smart to sponsor something like Arts America, which is also works both ways. It also brings artists to the United States from other places and lets them share their work here, which is very important. But the job of penetrating stereotype when you get into international relations is critical. And so to bring artists, to enable artists to travel to other countries and present their work and also the work of other people from their own country helps, I think, very much in penetrating a certain kind of stereotype that is very easy for people in other countries to have about the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. And to also to see the, for them to be aware of the ease with which we identify ourselves as Americans, but at the same time could criticize something American or could be upset with something American. And that's one of our strengths as a country. Certainly we agree that you know, the job of Americans is not all to think the same thing, but to continue to say what we think. That's part of our country's great tradition. And I think that artists abroad represent that, that freedom. And also the challenge of making links wherever they may be made with human experience. How we may be so different in many external ways, but how many ways our experience links, which leads me up to my current life as an anthologist, I think.
Yes, yeah. I think so too. And to a book called This Same Sky, among others.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a book of poetry called This Same Sky that came out in 1992, a collection of poems from around the world selected by Naomi Shihab Nye.
Yes, and this book has been a very happy experience. Inside it has some of the stamps of the many countries and envelopes where the poems came from. I sort of sent an all-out call for, aren't these lovely stamps?
Yes.
Call for entries. I wrote to every writer I knew in every country, every translator I knew, and asked for them to send me work. The challenge of this book was I wanted it to be for younger readers, one of the challenges, for younger readers as well as for adults, not to be acute book in the kind of condescending way that many times people think, well, that's for a younger reader. Let's give them a cute little rhyming poem and make them happy.
From Paraguay.
Right. And certainly I received stacks and stacks of poems like that, and someone else can do that book. But I wanted this to be poems of integrity, stylistic and thematic integrity that didn't condescend to a younger reader, but poems that were accessible to younger readers, but also an adult could read the book and feel at home. I started putting this book together, Susan, during the Gulf War, a time in which I felt extremely anxious about stereotyping that was going on in this country, about just the tremendous anguish of war and how much there was that we couldn't know about what was going on in Iraq at the time of the war, the human lives, people who were not involved with politics any more than I am in my daily life, who were being killed, molested, hurt, their lives changed irrevocably by a war over which they had no power. And being of Middle Eastern heritage, of course, I kept hallucinating. I couldn't sleep, thinking about I've never even been to Iraq, but just the smells and sights and sounds of children in the Middle East and what the days must be like for them. And so I started this I was working in schools in Texas at the time, and I started taking poems, whatever I could find from Iraq that was accessible to children, into these classrooms, and saying, you know, I'm not making a political statement here by sharing these poems with you, but I think it's very important at this time in history that we think about the human beings of Iraq, not just the dictators or the leaders or people making kinds of political wrong decisions or decisions, but everyday people like you and like me, and how are they doing? And some of my friends said, well, you probably won't be allowed to do that. Schools won't want you to come in and bring poems like that at this time. And it was exactly the opposite. The teachers were very grateful, and they said, you know, we're extremely troubled too. Many of the high school students were talking about how disturbed they were by a media presentation of the war and how things were being given these awful euphemisms that sort of made everything feel clean without pain, you know, collateral damage instead of, you know, dead,
surgical
innocent
strike.
Human beings. Mm-hmm. Things like that, yeah, and smart bombs and all these kinds of terms that were being used to sort of cast everything into the distance. And I've always felt that the job of poetry is to bring things closer, to bring us into closer focus with one another's lives. You know, you read a poem by someone you've never seen before, and if you're lucky, you are intimately connected with that person for a moment of reading the poem or afterwards. And so I thought it was important to use poetry at that moment to do what it does best. And hearing students talk about it, saying things like, you know, I hadn't really thought about the fact that there are children in Iraq, like you and me, and they're going to, are they in school today? What's happening? And then a teacher challenged me and said, well, you know, where'd you get these poems? We don't have sheaves of Middle Eastern poetry at home. Why don't you do a book for us that is poems from around the world? And so that's how this book started. And in fact, on the back of the book, there is a poem from Iraq. Who can open the door of the green river, of the golden clouds, of my heart, by Zuhur Dixon. It's called Overture. And I was glad that it went on the back. But
Find a poem by Pablo Neruda. There are, it's towards the back.
Right.
There are
right here.
Poems by 129 poets from 68 countries gathered in this volume. And this is one that stopped me in the middle of my day, made me smile, and then made me think. And I thought, what a lovely thing for a poem to do.
Good. Yes, this is by Neruda, great world poet from Chile, translated by William O'Daly. And this comes from a wonderful book recently published called Questions. Every line in it is a question, and this poem is questions. What is it that upsets the volcanoes that spit fire, cold, and rage? Why wasn't Christopher Columbus able to discover Spain? How many questions does a cat have? Do tears not yet spilled wait in small lakes? Or are they invisible rivers that run toward sadness?
A lovely poem.
Yeah.
It's in a section of this book called Losses. There are sections that allow us to look at poems representing the kind of collective images all the way through.
Yeah. Here's one from Mozambique by Jose Cravirinha, translated by Don Burness. It's called A Man Never Cries. I used to believe that story that a man never cries, and I used to think I was a man. In my youth, I dared not be a coward when we played our arrogant games of childhood, imitating the heroic man of steel in the movies. Now I tremble, and now I cry, as a man trembles, as a man cries.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It's a good arrival.
Yeah. We're taking a look at a book called This Same Sky, a collection of poems from around the world. It was published in 1992. By
Four Winds Macmillan.
Thank you. I have so many notes on this piece of paper, I can't find this one. Four Winds Macmillan.
And they also just brought out this children's book.
Lovely book. Naomi has been a poet for most of her life. She is branching out. This children's book, City's Secrets, published in 1994, is it for what age group?
Well, this is about age 4 to 8.
Age 4 to 8.
Yeah. Siti is the Arabic word for grandmother.
Ah.
And so it's about a child who lives on this side of the world and goes to see her grandmother on the other side of the world and learns about the bigger world.
Good. A bit of your life went into that one, I'll wager.
Yeah.
This is one of several children's books that's going to be coming out in 1994 and beyond. Naomi is also kind of leaping into the world of the young adult novel at this point in her life, having a new contract to write such a book. There's a book of collected nonfiction works by Middle Eastern women only?
Well, no, it's by men and women.
Men and women.
Yes, that Anton Jamas and I are editing that book.
If you would like to look for poems by Naomi, look for, in late 1994, the selected early poems from Far Corner Books and Eighth Mountain Press, earlier books called The Yellow Glove and Hugging the Jukebox of Naomi's own works. And the first one, Different Ways to Pray. These are award-winning books by Naomi Shihab Nye. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. This edition we're spending with poems and poetry of Naomi Shihab Nye and more. It is very nice to have you here.
It's great to be with you, Susan.
No, it's lovely. This Same Sky, you said you sent out to everyone you knew to send in poems.
Yeah, an invitation.
Did poems come from many more people than you knew?
They certainly did. In fact, I heard that in some countries where apparently not much was going on in the local news, my call for poems was printed on the front page of little newspapers.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So I received stacks of mail from places like Mauritius and Guyana in South America, and different countries where I really didn't have personal contact. Sort of things got passed along as they do between among writers, because I would say, spread the word, and if you know someone in another country, please invite them. And one wonderful thing was that I became aware of so many bodies of literature. I didn't know that much about Filipino writing, for example, when I started doing this book. And the Filipino poems that came to me were spectacular, wonderful. I could have used almost any of them that came. They were so good. And in fact, many writers would send, say, 10 or 20 poems by one author, and I would like all of them. I could have used any of them. And that was a really wonderful feeling, to be discovering all these writers. Same thing happened with Denmark. I received so many poems from Danish writers whom I had not known about before. Mm-hmm. From India, which is a real hotbed of literary arts, I received far, far more things than I could use.
Does this say to you that it's just impossible to truly know the literature of any other country, that there's such a wealth of literature out there in the globe?
Well, it's not impossible to know it in little bits. I never have that sense that I know everything, even about the literature of any place. But I think it's very encouraging for people who believe in the importance of writing and of reading. Because, there are a lot of pessimistic sorts out there who will say, well, they like to quote statistics and say, well, how many people read poetry, and as opposed to who knows what, romantic novels or something, and therefore why write it, which has always seemed like the most ridiculous kind of argument, you know, to say, well, more people do this than that, so why do that? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. You'll read these essays from time to time, and some people get depressed when they read that there are only maybe 100,000, you know, I don't know, I'm making up the figures, however many active readers of poetry, say, in the United States or wherever. But when you connect with all these people in other countries, I think it encourages you to think about the larger world and the large family of writers everywhere. Mm. I've never known how writers can say that it's a lonely profession or it's a lonely life, because to me, if you read, you can never be lonely. So I don't have that, share that view of it.
Lovely sentiment. Do you sense, on the other hand, that you could create anthologies for the rest of your life based on this call and other calls for poetry from around the world?
I'm sure that it could be a contagious activity. Right now I'm working on four other ones. So the next one after this one will be called, one of the next ones, That Tree is Older Than You Are, and it's poems and stories from Mexico, bilingual. And
where does that come from?
That'll be Four Winds McMillan, but only Mexico. Only Mexico. And it's a nice book, and it's going to include art as well from Mexico. And compiling that book, I was overwhelmed with possible good material.
Where does that phrase come from? That tree is older than you are?
It comes from a poem by Jennifer Clement, which is the first poem in the book, called Lemon. I think the poem's called Lemon Tree. And it's a mother speaking to a child, and I think it's a mother, or a child speaking to a child and saying, hey, listen to that tree. You know, we better pay attention to this tree because it knows a lot.
Yeah.
And what's in its branches and what's in its leaves. And mm-hmm. I was very attracted to the tree for many reasons. The lemon tree is a central image of my city book, because my grandmother has one growing in the middle of her patio. And so, you know, all these things connect, all these countries, yeah. But I think anthologizing is a contagious activity. And it's you can feel good about an anthology in a way that, and you can promote it almost in a way that you would your own book, because you're sort of like you've had this big dinner party and you've invited all these people to dinner, and now you want them to meet each other, and then you want all these other people out there to meet them. And so I've had a lot of fun reading from the same sky at different places and giving talks about the process of anthologizing. You know what? The word anthology comes from gathering of flowers. Isn't that nice?
Oh, how wonderful.
That's what it comes from. That's what an anthology is, from the Greek for gathering of flowers. Yeah. And there are hard parts of an anthology, too. Getting permissions, for example, which in many cases is a task that falls to the editor. And I'm not just a terribly organized person when it comes to those kinds of tedious details, but I've had to be better about it. And so I'm working on that now.
Has it, in some ways, kind of straightened out other aspects of your life, so to speak, if you've had to have to learn this discipline of...
Well, that would be nice, but I don't think it's rubbed off so far.
Perhaps
it
not.
Could. I have ideas about how it could. Maybe I need images.
That's right.
Yeah.
How interesting. Poet can't work on ideas. Doesn't make any sense. Introduce us to City's Secret.
Well, I'll just read the first couple pages, how the book starts. And I dedicate this to Siti Hadra Shihab Adeyes Alzair of Palestine, still alive at 105, and all grandmothers everywhere who give our lives gravity and light. And it starts out with a little girl is in her bed, and there's this wonderful map that's, the painting is superimposed over a map. And she starts out, my grandmother lives on the other side of the earth. When I have daylight, she has night. When our sky grows dark, the sun is peeking through her window and brushing the bright lemons on her lemon tree. I think about this when I am going to sleep. Your turn, I say. Between us are many miles of land and water. Between us are fish and cities and buses and fields and presidents and clotheslines and trucks and stop signs and signs that say do not enter and grocery stores and benches and families and deserts and a million trees. Once I went to visit my grandmother. My grandmother and I do not speak the same language. We talked through my father as if he were a telephone, because he spoke both our languages and could translate what we said. I called her Sitti, which means grandma in Arabic. She called me Habibi, which means darling. Her voice danced as high as the whistles of birds. Her voice giggled and whooshed like wind going around corners. She had 1,000 rivers in her voice. And it goes on describing the child's introduction to the grandmother's world and how they invent their own language together and they don't need the father anymore for talking. And she grows very attached to these very different ways that the grandmother lives. And I would hope, you know, Susan, when I was growing up, I never, ever once read a book that had any kind of connection to my personal heritage. You know, there just weren't, that many years ago, that many bicultural, multicultural books as there are now. And in recent years, the publishing industry has become very conscious of this, and there are many wonderful books that relate to Latina, Latino culture, or African-American culture, whatever, Asian-American culture. And there are more now that do relate to Arab-American culture. But I would hope that, you know, a child who reads this book, for example, I have a friend whose children's grandparents live in Sweden, and I was hoping that when they read the book, they wouldn't be thinking about my grandmother so much as about their own and their own link to another place. So it's really for anybody who's ever been connected to more than one place in the world, and also for maybe people in Alaska, because you have light at times when other people don't, and so children here have a different sense of day and night.
There are some lovely bright shining children's lines in there that she would go to bed, get ready to go to sleep, and the last thing she would say to her grandmother is, "Your turn."
Yeah, it's thanks.
Very nice.
Thanks. Yeah.
In writing a children's book, is there a different part of the poet that comes out, or is it?
Well, maybe a younger one.
Uh-huh.
I think a younger one that feels that sense of how you like to hear a story when you were little and how you like to tell a story. Now, as a parent, the kinds of books that I like to read. My next book after this one is called Dream Bottle, and it's really taken from a story that our son used to tell when he was 2 about where dreams came from in human beings. And the whole story spun out from that, and then I introduced all these characters and made it, you know, have a plot and a grandma in it, too. But writing it, I had that real sense of his voice as a child, my voice as a child, how I thought of things then. You know.
A lot of what you're saying is oral again.
Yeah, it's oral, very much. And that book is very much conversations between people bouncing back and forth. You know, she says, he says, they say, this person says. Bringing the ear in.
Do you, has having Madison, having a son, put your mind to children's books?
Tremendously much, yes, because I've been reading hundreds of them every month, and he's been reading for a long time himself, but he still likes to be read to, which is a great treasure part of our day, and definitely, and having his voice in my life, our lives, has been such a richness, hearing language rediscovered in the way that a child rediscovers it and employs it, so much more interesting than the ways that many adults come to use language. So vibrant, so vital, so particular, too. You know, now he's past that kind of early, wildly metaphorical, anything is possible stage. He's gotten a lot more practical in his language, but still very fanciful ways of, very direct, very blunt. So hearing that rhythm, yeah.
Poet Naomi Shihab Nye, her photographer husband Michael Nye, and son Madison Cloudfeather Nye all live together in San Antonio, Texas, where the sky, she says, is as big as Alaska's. You said at a craft talk very recently, I think writers live more interesting lives, not because of what we get to do so much as what we get to see. And you've just said that in 2 or 3 different ways regarding Madison and you.
And how we get to think about what we do, or how we get to think about what happens to us. Kim Stafford, who is the wonderful writer, son of William Stafford, a poet whose work I have loved since I was 15 years old and who died this past year. Mm-hmm. And he was a friend of many people in Alaska. I've met many people here who respected his work, and I know there was a tribute reading for him here. Well, Kim says, he quotes somebody as saying that we all need to have a story sense about our lives, that if we thought of our own lives as stories, that that it would be easier, you know, on the hard days, and it is, believe me, I employ this, that on days that just where things are just not going very well, they're not working out like you'd have them work out, or they're bumpy, they have all these jagged edges, or you don't feel good, or there's something not right, to be able to stand back from that and look at this as, well, this is the heart, the low part of a story here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then what happens in a story? Well, you turn the page and the story goes up again. You're able to look back at that. You know, that's very useful. And that's a very useful attitude. And so that's just talking maybe about writing, being able to write and being able to stand back from our lives as a kind of ability, a way to look. But it's not, I mean, it's not so much that, well, actually, I do think our lives become more full when we write because we think of them as being full. You know, you're not always waiting for something to happen. William Stafford has a quote in one of his books where he says, you know, even if I wrote as fast as I could, I would never catch up with the river that was my life. You know, there was so much going on. And I have that feeling, like here I have a little blue journal that I brought specially to write in Alaska, to write about things that happened during our 6 weeks here. And so much, every day is so full of amazing images, things people say, things we've read, things we've talked about, new discoveries, you know, whether it's some little thing at the grocery store that's different here that I'd like to remember, or some quote that someone says, or the aurora borealis, which we experienced for the first time the other night, and we're just overwhelmed by it. You know, I want to take lots of little notes now, not that I'm collecting it, you know, in a kind of souvenir way, but just because it's very precious and I want to remember little, you know, there's always more to remember than we can actively, and so to have some little documentation helps.
This is the obvious question, but do you think everyone, including, quote, non-writers, end quote, should write for that reason?
Yes, yeah. I do. I think they can give themselves, you know, I think if every human being wrote a paragraph a day just for themselves. You know, if people who think they have nothing to do with writing, well, just kept an ongoing book where you wrote a paragraph for yourself every day of something maybe that's very much in you that day but you're not able to talk about with other people, or something, some puzzle you're thinking about, or some memory that you can't shake off that day. Yeah, I think it would only contribute to every life.
You said something the last time we visited about using questions as springboards.
Right.
To run through that thought again, because it doesn't have to be questions like, how am I going to resolve this?
No. It can. You know, Nancy White Carlstrom, children's book writer who lives here and poet who lives here in Fairbanks, and I were just talking about this within the last 24 hours, that sense of allowing a question to kind of move into consciousness and open up so many images, you know, so many ways of looking. One of her wonderful books called Where Does the Night Hide? And I said, you know, that is such a rich question. You know, when it's daytime, where's the night? And each page goes on and takes us through some of the possible magical and close places that the night is when we're not aware of it. And I like to think of our kind, those kinds of ruminating questions,
you know, Pablo Neruda.
Yes, like Pablo Neruda poem. Kind of questions. Questions that you carry, the kinds of wonderments that you carry. Those are very important doors for us. And even if we don't answer the question, still the question itself as a door, that it can carry you, a question can carry you to another question, and you may, you know, find yourself on a very important journey through those questions. Many times when I sit to write, I still just sit down and write some questions that I'm carrying at that moment, and inevitably something will open up, and they don't necessarily have to be questions about my life at all. You know, it could be about a place or something else that seems mysterious.
Why didn't Christopher Columbus
discover
Spain?
Right? Isn't that wonderful?
It's a great question.
The things that are right beside us.
I want to ask you about a 6-year-old girl who started writing, and the next year sent poems out to be published. It's kind of a gutsy
that's
little
me.
Girl.
Oh,
yes,
is that me?
That
oh,
would
yeah.
be you.
Yeah.
Jane Goodall said that when she was a little girl, her mother noticed that she was always wandering around outside looking at bugs and other life forms and plants and rocks. And so Jane Goodall's mother brought her a notebook and said, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And she believes that the naturalist writer, the focused scientist who emerged because of the mother who said, write that down.
Yeah.
Did somebody in your life come like Jane Goodall and say, Naomi, write this down, or did you find the pencil yourself?
Well, for that first year of writing, grade one, I just found the paper, the pencil on my own. I had sort of an unhappy first grade experience. I did not feel very closely aligned with my teacher or with really the curriculum. I remember feeling very disassociated already from, you know, what she was saying was important for us to know about. And so writing immediately became a kind of territory of my own. It was my own frontier. It was my own place where I could explore things and where I could write down things that seemed more important to me. And so that year there wasn't anyone. My parents were always very neutral, open in their response, not particularly enthusiastic or pushy about, well, do more of this. And I think that was good in retrospect. I knew they would listen or look at anything I showed them, and they wouldn't be critical, and they also wouldn't, you know, sort of start hounding me to do it more. Mm-hmm. I did have a second grade teacher, though, Harriet Lane in St. Louis, who believed that poetry was at the heart of all the universe and at the heart of all learning, and she had us writing and editing books of our own throughout all of second grade, and that was the year that I started sending things out to magazines. And when my first poem was published in a magazine, I remember the principal had me come down and read it on the intercom, which was kind of a new invention in those days,
right,
in the schools, and he asked me, he said, is it because of Harriet Lane that you sent this poem to the magazine? Well, I kind of lied. I said, yes, she is the reason, I knew she would be happy if I did it. I knew at the moment I said that wasn't the reason, because I'd already been writing a year before I'd ever met her. But at that moment, she was very actively involved in my sense of poetry. And she wasn't a tremendously nurturing teacher in some ways. I mean, she was very, very strict, very, very small patience with undisciplined seven-year-olds. And if we didn't pay good attention, we got a little bop on the head. And so we all lived in a kind of little tremor, slight tremor of awe around her. I did get to see her when she was past 90, and I was by this time publishing books and things, and invited her, got someone to bring her to a reading I gave, and I gave a big testimonial about how she'd been such an important person in my formative years. And her one comment afterwards, which I thought was so wonderful, was, well, I need to go home now, it's very late, but, you know, I'd just like to ask you a lot of questions. And then she went off, and her number was... by the next year was no longer listed, so I presume she had passed on. And you know, I think that's what she got us to do for ourselves that year of being seven, was ask those questions. And what did we want to write about? What did we know about? What poems did we respond to? So, yes, I had her energy there at a crucial time. And maybe I wouldn't have been so inspired to keep doing it without her. Yeah.
Here's to Harriet.
Teachers, you know, they never know how important they are to... what we carry from them out there in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask you about your own teaching, but kind of another side of it. I've been curious, you can bat this question aside if it's a silly one, but I've been curious about what American teenagers are writing about in 1994 when they're writing poetry. Is it a huge world of poetic choices that you see coming out?
Well, I think teenagers in general have a very important emotional developmental kind of stage to go through in terms of relationships with one another and with their coming years, with their own adulthood. And I think wherever teenagers are, whether they're in Bethlehem or whether they're in Texas, or maybe I'll find out whether they're in Bethel or Nome or Unalaska, that kind of identification of what it is we feel, what we feel and all the myriad mixtures of things that we feel, which are very perplexing when you're in those years. And I think that's kind of a universal quest area. I do think that teenagers these days are very conscious of the news and the world, and I find elements of issues in many poems. And I think due to the, I would say, the more promising way that literature is being taught in many places, in the sense that I think many teachers are much more devoted to connecting students with process of writing and with where literature comes from in our lives, much more than, say, 25 years ago when I was in high school. Many teachers who've been parts of these writing projects in different states where the teachers themselves are actually writing, and they know, you know, where do we turn for material into our own experience? How does that experience link us up with other people's experience?
So teaching youngsters how to access the muse.
Yes, sort of. And more through their own lives. So I think there's a stronger bent, I hope this is true, toward very concrete material too, as well as like very particular imagery from daily life. I feel that happening around the country, places like the Geraldine Dodge Foundation up in New Jersey that sponsors this huge poetry festival for high school students, and Bill Moyers made a TV program out of that festival called The Power of the Word. And it's had a tremendous effect because schools all over the United States have those tapes. And, you know, when you have these contemporary poets talking about, well, here's a poem about my father, and this is why I wrote it, and these are some of the issues that I think we need to explore in our own relationships. The poems seem to me to be getting better in schools in many ways. I think there's a higher level of a sense of one's own particulars, one's own details, one's own moments.
You have an anthology coming out, one or more, of poems by teenagers?
No, not by teenagers, but four.
Four.
Paul Genesco, who's a well-known American anthologist, and I are doing an anthology for teenagers that's a kind of a gender book. He and she, various perspectives on things, and that's going to be specifically for teenagers.
Oh, nice.
And then I was also invited to be one of the editors on the forthcoming new edition of that landmark anthology, Reflections on a Gift of Watermelon Pickle, that first came out in the 60s. Well, there's a new edition coming out in 94, which will contain many more women and many more multicultural voices. And so I was one of the editors on that new edition and things like that.
In some ways, our as you said, better poems coming out by teenagers now, connected with not only teachers learning to write themselves and learning to teach writing from a personal perspective, but also the number of books that
Yes, absolutely. The number of books that are available now, and the more lively text of many of the basic textbooks that are used in literature programs in high schools, say, I think they're much better than they were. I'm worlds better than they were 25 years ago. And so I think that helps a lot. We model. You know, as writers, we model on what we read, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing to do. And so if students are reading more various kinds of voices and traditions, then I think they feel more at home with their own.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, I think just to be properly grateful, we should also thank, I should thank, the National Endowment for the Arts, which has sponsored my trip here to Alaska this time and gave a grant to the Department of English here at UAF to have me. And I'm really honored to be invited back to this state in particular, because I knew when I was here before that there were many more things in Alaska that I wanted to listen to and know about than I was able to even have access to on one quick trip. So it's good to be back here. Really terrific.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up, because I haven't said in this half hour and want to. There are people who remind me to say how people got here,
yes,
which is so that you didn't just kind of spring full-blown
right
in the chair. Naomi has been brought to us, as she said, by a grant from the National Endowment by the Arts, proposed by Frank Sos and Peggy Shoemaker of the University of Alaska Fairbanks English Department. Naomi is one of the many visiting writers brought to the university and thus to Fairbanks and thus to the interior in all these different ways and venues by the University of Alaska Fairbanks English Department. This is Conversations. You're listening to it on KUAC-FM. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want you to read again. And I want you to read one of my favorite poems, if you wouldn't mind. This one's called Sure. And it's a poem from the book yellow glove. I cover briefly as Naomi picks it up and looks for it on page 23, and it's back to grandmothers.
It's back to grandmothers, yeah. And here's my other grandmother popping up, my German-American grandmother. Sure. Today you rain on me from every corner of the sky, softly vanishing hair, a tiny tea set from Mexico perched on a shelf with the life-size cups. I remember knotting my braid on your bed 10 months into your silence. Someone said you were unreachable, we could chatter and you wouldn't know. You raised yourself on magnificent, dying elbows to speak one line, "Don't be so sure." The room was stunned. Lying back on your pillow, you smiled at me. No one else saw it. Later, they even denied they heard. All your life, never mind. It hurts, but never mind. You fed me corn from cans, stirring busily. I lined up the salt shakers on your table. We were proud of each other for nothing. You, because I finished my meal. Me, because you wore a flowered dress. Life was a tablet of small reasons. "That's that," you'd say, pushing back your chair. "And now let's go see if the bakery has a cake." Today, as I knelt to spell a word for a little boy, it was your old floor under me, cool sections of black and white tile. I'd lie on my belly, tracing their sides. St. Louis, movies sold popcorn, baby lions born in zoos. The newspapers would never find us. One moth lighting on the sink in a dark apartment years ago. You point. Should I catch it? Oh, never mind. A million motions later, I open my hand, and it is there.
Sure. My favorite poem from Yellow Glove by Naomi Shihab Nye. Naomi, this has been lovely. Thank you very much.
Susan, you are the nicest interviewer in the world. I'll come to Alaska any year to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Good. Come back. We'll talk again. What a nice thing to say.
You are.
Look for Naomi's poems. The selected early poems will come out in late 94 from a combined effort by Far Corner Books and Eighth Mountain Press, both of Oregon. Naomi says Eighth Mountain Press is her favorite feminist press, and she loves being published by these two together. Red Suitcase from Boa Press will come out in late 94. New poems by Naomi Shihab Nye. Look for City's Secrets. Did I say that right?
City, yes.
City's Secret. Mm-hmm. Touch those T's. City's Secrets. In 1994 from Four Winds. That's the first of a series of children's books, and that book is now out and about. The anthology we talked about is This Same Sky, also by Four Winds Press. It came out in 1992. Those are lovely poems from around the world, poems collected for young people, but I must say at this advanced age, I adored it.
Oh, good.
Coming up, look for two anthologies, four teens of poems, and tell me when the nonfiction by Middle Eastern writers
will emerge. That'll be out sometime next year from Persea Books.
Okay, 1995.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Lots under the belt and lots to come from Naomi Shihab Nye, and I'm sure there's more percolating. This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. It's been a pleasure to have Naomi and a pleasure to have you with me. I hope you join me again next week. Thank you a lot.
Thank you, Susan.
Nice.